From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, as we always do on Innovation Friday, we're going to cover a lot of ground over these 2 hours. Later in this hour, we're going to talk about road paving. You've probably got neighbors paving driveways, or you've seen road paving crews getting ready to go. But you might not have ever thought about environmental road paving and the possible impact there. We're going to get into that a little bit later. But first, a great pleasure of mine whenever you can bring in great movie clips, you have to do it. And so Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, and I were discussing a great opportunity to do that. Matthew, how are you?
Well, Evan, thank you. Good to be here again.
Nice to have you and the great work of the team from Innovation Trail. And so most of our listeners have at least heard of the movie Office Space. You might not have seen the movie Office Space, but you've probably heard of it. If you've seen it, you know a very famous scene from it in which some frustrated office employees take out their frustrations. Now, Matthew, when I think about the frustrating office equipment that we have, I could probably think of a few systems that I think are slightly outdated that occasionally I want to take a baseball bat to. Anything stand to mind to you?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is I think the office printer is often the kind of the focus of a lot of workplace frustration.
Workplace violence.
Well, as we'll hear, yes, indeed. So this is a kind of a nice long setup to the discussion we're going to have about a whole lot of stuff. But as soon as we kind of reference this scene, if you share this kind of popular culture moment, people will know what we're talking about.
So here's the scene. A couple of employees in the office are frustrated, and it finally bubbles over. They are frustrated with the office printer. Let's listen.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly what I need.
Let's do that. Let's do exactly that.
No, not again. Why does it say paper jam when there is no paper jam? I swear to God, one of these days, I just kick this out the window.
You and me both, man. Thing is lucky I'm not armed.
The next scene, they go to a hip-hop montage, and they take it out to a field, and they take baseball bats to that office printer. That's from the movie Office Space. That's a long setup to give us a little laugh, but what are we talking about, Matthew?
So we're in the studio, we've got with us Jeff Shaw. Jeff's the founder and chief tech strategist for Pharos Systems, Pharos being the lighthouse of ancient antiquity, and Dale McIntyre, who's senior VP with Pharos Systems. And you guys are in the printing business, so this is why we had to have a joke at your expense.
Not at your expense. He's the one who's curing that issue.
we'll see. Yeah. But the reason we want to talk to you is because you're a Rochester-based company, but you've also you also began a little way further to the south, I understand, in terms of the original concept for the company. So we just wanted to talk about innovation, what's going on with printing, the impact of the cloud, all that kind of stuff. So Jeff, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit of the backstory to Pharos Systems, now based in Rochester, but originally from Auckland, New Zealand.
Well, we weren't offended by the joke on the printer frustrating people who they beat it to death.
Have you seen the movie, by the way? Is it popular in New Zealand?
Yes, that movie must be a couple of decades old.
It is. It's remarkable. To me, it still feels fresh. It's probably 15 years old now.
But I think that the human sentiment still survives.
Right.
You know, the level of frustration on anything. But anyway, getting back to your question, why Rochester? Why from Auckland? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Well, if the topic is innovation, you know, I've always shied away from the word innovation because it's like it's a great view. It's kind of almost feels like a meaningless word, but in terms of holding a conversation to get understanding, I guess it takes you in that direction. But way back in 1993, we were asked by the local university, University of Auckland, to help them with a problem that they had, and they were getting cost overruns with their printing, and they wanted to see how they could control it. But their focus was both on the printers and the abuse the printers were put under by the student population.
Now, when you say abuse, you mean misuse, kind of fraudulent use, or just that the printers were getting a huge hammering from students?
I would say nothing about fraudulence. More that it was they were getting a hammering because the technology that we have today that existed way back in that era allows people to access documents that they could print, or pictures that they could print, or books that they could print. And because print was freely available, they would do that. And then who paid for it? the university.
Right, right. So this was stuff that people, but these might have been legitimate. I mean, these were legitimate, you know,
yes.
study purposes. People yes. needed to and at the, you know, at the time you're talking about, there weren't, you know, kind of virtual. The PDF hadn't been invented potentially. I mean,
no.
that's the thing. So this was, but people were printing out huge amounts of hard copy. So what was the way that you started to think about a solution for ways that, you know, in terms of the problem was really what the university's was an economic problem, essentially.
It was, and in those days too, a lot of information wasn't readily available, and so what is in essence invisible, you don't know what's causing the events or the frustration. You can't find a way to say, can we solve the problem? So in essence, we made what was invisible visible, and you can call that the innovation. We focused on the users, because it's not printers that print, it's users that print. And if you look at the user behavior, you can determine what is best suited for the user to be productive still, but at the same time, allow the organization who's paying for the print infrastructure to control the costs. So what we did is that we determined that the best way of controlling it was to have the user who wants to print a job to actually present themselves at the printer to then release the print job while they're at the printer, which is it was a new concept way back in 1993, and this concept called pull printing.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that people would be very familiar with now if they're in an office or an academic environment, that they
yes.
have like a user ID or a,
yes.
you know, some sort of PIN number
yes.
that they go in, that basically it means you're able to monitor the workflow, you're able to see
yes.
where the demands are, you're also able to attribute cost around cost centers, you know, the way that cost centers are structured within a company. But now we take that for granted. In 93, this was a new way of thinking about it.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
So we've taken it further, and in the last 20 years, we've got a lot of industry expertise now and knowledge, and through the, you know, we've probably got over a couple of thousand higher education institutes using our solution, and we've moved, about 10 years ago, we moved into the corporate arena,
yep.
and through this exercises, we've found a lot more that we could do to help customers benefit from managing their print infrastructure.
Do you think that anyone who's kind of used printers within a corporate office environment stuff, it kind of seems overly complicated? I mean, has that been one of the things that there can be quite a number of steps, or, you know, if anyone has problems with IT, they're inevitably calling their IT expert or their IT support person to kind of deal with it. You know, is that also something you've tried to adjust, just trying to simplify the workflow and the kind of troubleshooting sort of aspect of it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what we're addressing today. You know, and something that we've picked up over the years, that a lot of organizations, their IT infrastructure was siloed, whether it was a faculty or department, and each department managed its own IT services. And there's a movement towards centralizing that. When you centralize it, you bring a lot of work into one area. I'll give you an example. We have a current client that has 400 servers, and those servers are upgraded multiple times during a year, whether it's for the operating system being changed, or it's security issues, or it's fixes and whatever they need to have done. That's a lot of IT cost. And at the same time, they still have to maintain the services to their client, who are the employees who want to print.
Right.
Our next wave of solution for the market is what we term our beacon solution, and that's going to be based in the cloud. And all that IT infrastructure will be then taken out of the hands of a company, and that's the worry and the cost and the frustration we heard at the start of this meeting, where people wanted to smash their printer with a baseball bat, I guess the feeling's still there. We want to remove that to make it a lot easier experience for the user,
yeah.
and the means that the operation or the organization that has the printer, their costs are controlled, and that they get benefit overall.
Right. So is the weak link in the whole thing, if you've got a system that's working, you still got to do with hardware? I mean, I think anyone who's worked in offices for any length of time remembers getting the Xerox service guy comes in, he unpacks his briefcase, and then he's there for like 3 days, you know, with kind of, you know, the really, really, you know, the 150-piece Phillips head screwdriver set, and he's kind of pulling. You know what I mean?
Like, yes,
there's
I just do.
Let's assume you got all these systems doing. You've still got these real these, you know, mechanical hardware you know, kinds of assets, you know, that'll do what they're going to do, or they're going to get worn down, or they're going to be, you know, be a weak link in the system at some point, depending on how they're maintained, right?
Yes, we're not really concerned so much about the printer, the hardware itself. Ours is a change management, and it's a software solution,
right?
And it's consultative solution as well, in terms of us giving the best direction. And we know that because we accumulate such a large amount of data. And with that data, you can do a lot of important analysis. And from the analysis, you can see trends and you can see the best practices, which hasn't always been, that information hasn't always been available. To be fair, I think printers and copy machines have, the mechanics of those have improved a lot since the last 20 years. And so, but that's not our area. You know, we work with any model or any manufacturer's device, which makes us kind of unique. So if you're dealing with one manufacturer, their focus is their devices. Our focus is any device.
Right.
So long as it can print, so long as it has an output function, we're on top of it.
Right. So, and Evan's going to jump in any minute now with an interesting question, but
okay.
but I was going to ask you about to what extent has the whole sort of sustainability issue or philosophy kind of influenced, you know, consumption, issues around consumption? I mean, have clients come to you with using words like sustainability or consumption, or is it always in the terms of cost, or are they also seeing these other other kinds of...
Yes, sustainability is big.
Right.
And
since about when? Since when did you... I'm just interested in when you started to see that sort of change in workplace cultures and stuff.
I probably can't give you a close date, but I would say at the turn of the millennium.
Right.
2000, right? When we began to see some of the benefits, i.e., at that time, a lot of printing was printing out for email. So we introduced a control policy mechanism where if we see email being printed, we can alert the user to say, do you realize this is going to kill so many trees? And I'll take that a wee bit further. And one of our clients, I'm sure they won't mind me talking about this, Coca-Cola, they have a park in Atlanta across the head office called Piedmont, I think.
Yeah.
And by way of reinforcing, you know, good practices or mindful printing, is to show the end user what the impact that they're having on the environment. And so in 2007, if you took a measurement of the trees in Piedmont Park, and you took the measurement of trees in Piedmont Park in 2010 for 3 years, you'd have seen that, and if all those trees were used for making paper, you'd see that half the forest had disappeared.
Right.
So we can show through, you know, mindful printing that you can save on the environment. And I'll give you another example. There was a pharmaceutical company that we did an analysis on. We were watching the printing habits of 5,000 users, and in 1 year they printed less paper than the years before, but what they printed less would have amounted to 1.3 times the height of the Empire State Building. Right, so that's a lot of paper. That's a lot of environmental impact. But the next question too is not so much the paper itself, but what do you do with that paper? How do you destroy it? What do you file it? Is it secure? So that is another issue that we take care of. There was a major retail company that did a study some years ago that determined that it cost them 9 cents a page after the paper was printed. 9 cents in terms of destroying it, 9 cents in terms of keeping it secure, 9 cents in terms of the effort to file it. So not only is the cost in the printing, the cost is in what happens after. And it's interesting, even the cost of the printing itself, and it's easy to say, and you know, everybody knows it costs 2 cents to print a black and white page of paper. There's a company that did a study and found that it cost them 4 cents to deliver the paper to the printer. So you get the cost of printing, you get the cost of delivering paper to the printer, then you get the cost of what you do to the paper after it's printed. So all these are big issues and costs, but they also impact on the environment. One of the other methods that Coca-Cola uses is to say, you know, for every page of paper that is printed, it uses one Coca-Cola can of good water, pure water. So, you know,
I can see they're attaching all these sorts of costs. So the other factor, I guess, for me, the question I have is just around human behavior and the tendency that sometimes, you know, the quickest, actually the most efficient thing can be just to print an email, you know. And yes. So how do you sort of balance, I guess, you know, the anthropology of it and those other things? I mean, are they discussions you get into when you're sort of looking at, you know, looking at how, you know, large corporations and individual at the individual level, you know,
yes,
what their work practices are like?
Well, you know, the work practices become habitual, and what's habitual becomes invisible, and you just do it, and you have even expectations that what you did today you can do tomorrow. So then when you make the invisible visible, you can say, well, we now need to make a change. And so there's kind of a change management process here, which we also control, and our customers come to us to help them with that change management. Hence, that's why we give feedback that's positive to the user to reinforce a positive action and to create a positive habit.
Right.
That's reinforced by the value that I'm giving to the environment, for one.
Right.
It's Innovation Friday and Connections, and my the editor of the Innovation Trail, Matthew Leonard, is an Australian who held his nose to invite a New Zealand guest, and that's Jeff Shaw here.
So not true. I love New Zealand. I lived there for 5 years. My wife's from New Zealand. There you go.
I'm mostly kidding. But to reset it for some of our listeners, because I do understand that a portion of our audience might have been sort of blacked out at the top of the hour, and that was long since corrected. But if you missed sort of the setup here, Jeff Shaw is with Faro Systems. Not only interesting to hear his story about the route that brought him to Rochester, but some of the innovations in the American office place. And we opened the hour with a clip from the movie Office Space, which is sort of a popular phenomenon here in this country years after it started. I also am thinking of another kind of a pop culture reference, and if you'll forgive me, but there's a real question here, Jeff. So, and the American TV show The Office, there was Steve Carell and the team had to create a new ad campaign, and they created this ridiculous schmaltzy 1 minute long ad, and it ends with the slogan, which is of course making fun of the stupidity of Michael Scott, the manager: limitless paper in a paperless world. So obviously he's missing the point that they're becoming obsolete, but the notion of a paperless world is not necessarily where we're going. It sounds to me like 10, 20, 25 years from now, it's not a paperless office, but a more sustainable office with a better kind of a better hand on the pulse of what sustainability means. Is that fair to say?
Yes, and it's almost an awareness of what you're doing. And this is what Mindful Print's about, knowing what you're doing and the impact of what you're doing.
But we're not going paperless in 25 years.
Absolutely not. You know, it was about 1995, I was watching, I'm not sure what movie I was watching, but the guy who had written a book called The Paperless Office, and he said it's now in its fifth print.
Right.
You know, I like paper. I prefer paper than reading on a electronic device, be an iPad or a Kindle. Although I also like getting books on my iPad or Kindle, because that means it takes up less space in the bookshelf and I can carry it around with me. I can carry 10 books around with me when I'm traveling and they're just there. But when I'm in the office, I like printing because I like reading paper. You call it old-fashioned, I'm that sort of guy. And I don't, and I think it's like the typical human reaction when I want to smash this printer with a baseball bat because this frustrates me. I think there's also a typical human reaction, which I'm probably expressing, to say, I like paper.
Yeah.
And so I don't think print's going to go away. It just needs to be managed more. It needs to be made more intelligent and mindful.
Right. And there are also particular sectors. I'm thinking of the banking and the legal industry. If anyone's ever closed on a house and they see the trees, the section of the Amazon that went up in flames in order to be able to sign all the documents that are related to signing a loan or something, you know, yeah. And they all have to be hard copy at the moment. I'm just saying there are still some core sectors,
yes.
Very high users.
And that seems ridiculous, doesn't it? Doesn't that seem excessive?
Yes, it is. When you all the information you get during the mail, you know,
signed five different times, five different places.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And it's kind of like, it's frustrating. I hope mail goes away because I hate opening envelopes. I'd rather do everything electronic.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's an area that I would like to see disappear. Because
I thought you said you like paper.
I like paper, I like reading, but I don't like mail. I don't like going to my letterbox
yeah,
every day,
there,
having
yes.
to empty my mailbox because we get a box by our kitchen table that's full of paper that we get through the mailbox.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I do have a couple of questions that have come in electronically,
mm-hmm. okay.
not via paper, if right. you don't mind. Megan says, I might have missed it, but I still don't understand what the cloud is, and that was referenced earlier.
That's a very good question, Megan. Thank you for posing it. So what do you mean when you're talking about the cloud?
That is a good question. There's a lot of businesses now that have used the cloud infrastructure, be it Netflix, be it Microsoft Office 365. And a lot of businesses' accounting systems, like we have an accounting system called NetSuite that's in the cloud, meaning that the information that is collected isn't stored in your company's or a company's servers. The information is sent out to a server that they don't know where it is.
Right. So it's not. So Megan is saying, yeah, it's not like it's not stored on hard drives in the basement.
Yes.
Of XXI
yes.
or Pharos. It could be a system of servers that could be in the United Arab Emirates. It could be in Kansas City. It could be in.
But it's managed
wherever.
By somebody else. It's
right.
that whole infrastructure, which you pay for, of course, but its cost isn't large because many people use the same service.
Right.
So if one person uses your single service in your company, then your company pays for that whole service. But if your service is shared by many people, the costs go right down. And also the expertise required for that service is held in one place, out in the cloud. We don't know where it is. You can find out if you want to, but it doesn't matter. So that your IT expertise is in that cloud area. They do the backup. They make sure that they're up and running 24/7, and it's not on your company's shoulders or the organization's shoulders to worry about that.
Yeah. So, and in terms, so just to quickly before Evan's other question that's come in. So what does that mean in terms of printing, in terms of you know, how documents are managed and so on? If a lot of that stuff is being pushed off in virtual form,
yes.
Does that mean that there are certain documents that may never hit a piece of paper, that they may just always exist in that
yes.
e-version?
Yes.
You like?
Understand, I just want to put this plug in here. We ensure that every document is fully secured too, because security is very important in the...
Sure, that was definitely another question, yeah.
So that gives a lot more opportunities in terms of the us knowing what people's habits are, how we can provide good information to them that allows them to make the best choices in terms of what they need, what their end users need. We have a product feature called Document Analytics or Doculytics that allows you to, through a dashboard, determine, see what is actually going on by the minute.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just trying to let Matthew know that we do have a call. You want to grab the call? Should we grab
absolutely.
The call? I think we still have time with this guest. This is John in Rochester talking about e-ink devices. Go ahead, John.
Hi. I enjoy the conversation, but I'm a little concerned about the ignoring of e-ink devices. Within the next 5 years, we'll have devices on the market that will be about the same size as 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper that will be able to do active video. Within the next 10 years, the size of those devices are going to shrink by an order of magnitude or more. And within the next 25 years, those same devices will be possibly flexible. And I understand this is a good thing to be doing now, but I think maybe selling the technology a little short.
John, hold on. You kind of blinked out. You said in the next 25 years, these devices will be what?
Flexible.
Flexible.
Flexible, meaning you won't be able to tell the difference between a sheet of paper that is electronic ink and updatable versus, common paper today.
I think you're talking about Harry Potter's newspaper?
No, not quite that sophisticated, no. But something along those lines, at least matching the feel, although you may never get across a slate format. You will eventually have something that is a form factor that has the tactile sensations.
I agree.
Paper.
I don't know whether that material is found yet, or it's, there's certain industries moving in that direction. I'm not aware of them. But undeniably, yes, that's going to be a major paradigm shift in terms of expectations, just as much as the e-reader has been, as much as the car was taken over the horse. New technology comes in, it's more beneficial, and there's a change. And most definitely you're going to see the change that you're suggesting come into effect. But when, I don't know. But we're not fully always focused just on what's printed. Our business is also focused on the distribution of information and the tracking of information.
So just to... Thanks for your question, John. And that was that's interesting, very interesting for me. One of the things I wanted to ask you about just a little bit more broadly was just making the leap from making the leap into the US market from, a small country of 4 million people, New Zealand. And why was there something about some of the residual knowledge in the Rochester area because of the legacy industries here that sort of caused you to sort of land here, or was it by chance, or were there other factors that were in place, in terms of, establishing a presence for the company here in the States?
For people who can't see me, I'm smiling. There's no one factor. There's many factors, and I don't know whether I could make any collective sense out of the many factors. But, if a decision was made, and you said it was a good decision, I think it was a good decision to come to Rochester. And it wasn't because of any intelligent design. And it wasn't because we're mindful. We're mindful about printing, but we weren't so mindful about coming to Rochester. But it was a decision that I think has turned out really well for us, because we've found in the Rochester community the type of resource that's really good. The openness, the area of expertise. And funny enough, I love the climate. My wife, who I brought with me, of course, from New Zealand, hates the cold. And our first year of being in the US, we were in Houston, Texas. And then when I told her we're moving up to Rochester, New York, our friends were telling us how cold it was, and I'm just going, shh, don't tell her. I keep hearing these stories. I mean, you put gas in your car and your hands are freezing and you think it's cold, it gets colder. And I'm going, oh, be quiet. Anyway, cut a long story short, we come to Rochester and it doesn't matter. I mean, if it gets cold, you dress for it. And my wife has no qualms.
So, in terms of the kind of the business, I mean, because we talk a lot about the business environment in Rochester and the kind of environment, the sort of climate for investment, all that kind of stuff. What's your observation as a company operating in here? Around attracting new businesses, the kinds of initiatives that are in place, for making a difference in terms of the business environment. And this has been obviously a long term project for the community here.
I think it's encouraging when there's a lot of operations and organisations now looking to foster startups, to look at opportunities for new industry, from the work that's been done with RIT, of all the good stuff that's done with that, to some of the organisations that are just picking up, and they bring good speakers from overseas to come and talk. I've been to a talk in the University of Rochester. where you know we've had people who are doing research from Google to you know the Ithaca University talking about their research and where that's going, and most of the attendees to those meetings were people in startups and looking to see how where's an opportunity for me in a startup, an opportunity for me to grow the business. And I think Rochester seems like my point of view, a great place for that.
Let me begin to wrap this conversation on a couple quick notes here. First of all, John, who called earlier, I'd like to carry that conversation with you forward outside of this hour. So if you can email me, edawson@wxxi.org, and any of our listeners can do that if you want to jump into conversations. You can also jump on Twitter at Evan Dawson, or you can call the program as you heard. But a last quick question comes similarly from our electronic form, and we'll keep it brief, but we'll close with Mark's point. He says, too many companies ignore sustainability because they think it's a financial loser. Do you agree with that, Jeff?
No. I don't agree with that.
I'm not saying do you agree that it's a financial loser. No. Do you agree that companies are concerned about sustainability because they think what does it cost?
I think it's a matter of education, and it's a matter of being aware of what's going on, and you know being mindful of what's going on, and when they can see the impact on the environment, that they, I believe, see it as being a positive. And on, not necessarily it's a cost thing. It's a human action thing. So again, what I said before, you need to be aware of the impact of your choice of doing something. So if you want to print off, you know, 100 pages, or you make a mistake with printing and you print 100 pages off, you're not going to read. What that impact is on the environment, and if that's brought to people, you know, to the user's attention, then they can change their behavior. And I think as much as you focus on the individual, the company reflects the individual. So the company is made up of many individuals, but the mindset is the same.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I make the mistake, by the way, of printing an article and not realizing there's a comment section attached to it that can go for 1,000 comments, and all of a sudden I have this panic moment where you're trying to cancel a job. Thanks for the conversation very much, Jared. Matthew, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks to Jeff.
Jeff Shaw from Pharos Systems and Dale McIntyre, who is the silent partner in the conversation.
He asked to be. He's the conscience in the room. Short break and come right back on Innovation Friday right here on Connections on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, medical interpreters. The launch of the Affordable Care Act has caused a surge in the need for interpreters. Limited English proficiency is a nationwide issue, and we'll explore how interpreters are addressing it. Then we'll check in with our team of Innovation Trail reporters around the state, covering the issues that matter to the upstate economy. That's coming up next hour on Innovation Friday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from FoodLink, the regional food bank, working with partners to ensure a hunger-free summer. Programs include meals for children, urban farm stands, and curbside market trucks. Learn more about FoodLink's efforts to build healthier communities at foodlinkny.org.
Welcome back to Connections. It's Friday, so it's Innovation Friday here. Matthew Leonard is the editor of the Innovation Trail, and we're shifting gears now, Matthew.
Right, absolutely. Welcome, Bill Johnson. Bill's is the operator of EcoSeal, which is a Rochester-based company. Just pull that mic in a little bit for you, Bill, just so you can hear. Yeah, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
Now, this was a totally new issue for me, and one that I think is kind of potentially really, really interesting. I wasn't aware that there'd been all of this research into the environmental and health impacts of coal tar pavement sealants. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've brought you into the conversation, Bill. Just tell us a little bit about your operation, you know, what your company does here in Rochester.
Well, we're based out of Greece, down by the lake, and we actually have a manufacturing plant that we built. And we make it. We make eco-friendly driveway sealer, which doesn't have carcinogens like the coal tar sealer.
Right. So the people are aware, the United States Geological Service has done a lot of research on this, and it's actually pretty controversial. I was just looking at some of the debates online, mm-hmm. some of the very kind of interesting arguments that are there online. But essentially, coal tar-based seal coat, the research is showing it's a potent source of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Mm-hmm. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs.
Right.
So first of all, what's different about the product that you're making compared to the traditional product?
Well, we make it without coal tar. It's petroleum based, and we have fillers and vinyl polymers in it.
Yep.
We have actually recycled rubber tires.
Uh-huh.
That's ground dust.
Yep.
You know, to put in. And all the stuff I learned in California. I went to California to learn this for 4 days. I spent out there with one of the biggest private people.
Right. So tell us why this has become such... Why should people care about what goes on their driveway?
Well, because after a while, coal tar creates dust. After wearing and driving cars and the dust tracks into the house. And because it's got the PAH, your kids, your animals, they all breathe this in. And all these studies, it's, you know, some people tell me, well, I don't believe it. I go, and I didn't make this up, you know.
Well, maybe I'd like to read from what the USGS put out just over a year ago.
Sure. Because
mm-hmm. it tracks exactly with what Bill is saying. And I think there's two points here. But first, let me read from the USGS release there. Friction from vehicle tires grinds pavement seal coat into small particles, or dust, as Bill mm-hmm. say, which are incorporated into the dust on the pavement surface. Dust on coal tar sealed pavement contains PAHs at concentrations that are hundreds of times higher than those in dust on concrete or unsealed asphalt pavement. Some of that contaminated dust is transported by wind, rain, and snow plows to nearby soil. Some is tracked into homes where it becomes part of house dust. Okay, so we're getting a picture for how it happens, but I'm always careful with this, and I know Matthew's been looking at this, and Bill, maybe you can touch on this more. I also don't want to be alarmist to the point where people hear hundreds of times higher of a ratio of PAHs, some of the dust ends up in your house. You may be thinking that if you have a normally sealed driveway like most people do, or you drive anywhere, most neighborhoods, you see people sealing driveways this mm-hmm. time of year. I don't want people to think that you're automatically, we're all getting cancer. You know. I don't know what the threshold is in terms of a contaminant that becomes harmful to people.
There hasn't been like a case
okay.
where somebody like got cancer from driveway sealer.
Right.
But what they're doing.
Or that we know of, I guess, right?
Right, right.
Okay.
They've had aquatic, like fish, die in streams. And this is how it all started, actually. There was a bank done in Carolinas. A heavy rain came out of nowhere. The bank was sealed with coal tar. It washed all into the catch basins, which went into the streams and storm. And there just happened to be one of the people that work on the USGS walking their dog and saw all the dead fish and wanted to know what right. was about. And that's how this all started.
Right. So they've run a lot of field tests. So runoff is one of the other big
runoff
issues
is big.
That people that, that
mm-hmm.
that's as Definitely. You're saying, and they've done a lot of field testing in New Jersey at their mm-hmm. Factory in New Jersey. The other thing to say, Evan, is that there's also legislation. There's legislation amongst a number of states and cities who are actually starting to look at putting some enforcement and some standards in it, including in New York State. There's a bill actually that went through the assembly mm-hmm. that was related to restricting, you know, and also putting label, you know, appropriate labeling so that people can make mm-hmm. you know, consumer choices. So where are we at? Do you know where we're up to with the legislation? Is that as far as I could see, I don't think it's gone through the assembly, but it hasn't gone through
the assembly
yep.
approved it,
yep.
but it sits before the Senate.
Right. Right. Like a lot of other yeah. legislation in New York
so
State, right?
It's just sitting.
Quite a lot, yeah.
Exactly, right. So, but the fact that there's been legislative change is obvious. I mean, that would obviously be a reason why, you know, you would be thinking in terms of your business that this would be a, you know, this is also an area to get into.
It's an alternative.
Right.
That's what I'm looking for. So when it does happen,
yep,
I'm ahead of the ball.
Right. So it's a precautionary thing. There's mm-hmm. definitely ongoing research showing that the high levels of PAHs that are in there. What sort of conversations do you have with people? I mean, how are you know, how receptive are to, you know, if you start saying, look, I've got this alternative traditional, you know, traditional sealant you might be using. How do you get started with getting people to?
Well, homeowners that are in, I would say, higher end homes, they want it.
Right.
Because they're just more cautious. Now, I shouldn't say more cautious, but they're not worried about any prices or anything. And I did have a lot of, once I show it, if I go on a bid opening or a walkthrough for, let's say, a school or daycare or somebody with a lot of pedestrian traffic, and I ask them, you know, what material are you using? And then I show them this stuff. I remember one guy who was a facilities manager said, I can't use the other stuff once I read this because legally?
I don't know. He might be talking about liability.
Liability issue. Right. He goes, and moral. You know, what if somebody did get sick? What if this did happen 10 years down the road? All of a sudden, somebody ended up with cancer from coal tar sealer from our school.
Right.
I'm not taking that chance.
Right.
He goes, he respected the whole job.
So it should be, and people may be interested in looking at some of the industry, you know, obviously the asphalt industry mm-hmm. Has put a lot of other stuff out there, and it's amazing how vigorous the debate is out there in terms of the kind of backwards and forwards, you mm-hmm. know, sort of discussions on. So I would encourage people who are, you know, who are interested or concerned about the issue, you know, really take it, you know, really try and do some research of your own online. And
I suspect the asphalt industry has a few things to say.
They indeed they do on their own website. But so, Bill, I mean, are you a green kind of guy? I mean, you know, just in terms of yourself, and you know, was it something, you know, the kind of the issues like the environmental stuff, was that something that you would have, you know, thought of before, or is it
not before?
Right
now, I drive a Prius.
Right,
you know what I'm saying? So it's like you can't pull up on a job with a Tahoe when you're a green type of person.
Right.
And it's got no fumes.
Just for our listeners, Bill definitely looks like a Tahoe kind of guy.
I was just going to say, if you meet Bill, you're expecting a pickup truck.
He's a Tahoe guy. He's a Ford F-150 kind of guy. But
you don't expect me in a Prius, then, is what you're saying.
but I find that fascinating, that you really feel that's important to the core of what you're doing.
When you like I said, you know, when you show up on a job, people that won't believe you. No matter what you have, as long as you got to believe it 100%.
Right. So in terms of just developing your own product, I mean, so you're working in Greece. Are you finding, you know, have you got enough business in the region? Are you looking to expand into other markets? What are the aspirations?
My goal is to franchise.
Right.
That's my goal.
Right. But producing and also franchising the production of the sealant or doing, right.
Or just the name. I already trademarked my name and my logo.
Yeah.
And to go around just sets businesses up.
Now, help me understand the process. And again, I've got some ignorant questions here, but I'm sure we all do on this issue, Bill. Mm-hmm. Most of us do have coal tar based sealed driveways, I assume, right? Mm-hmm. That's what most of it is.
Most of it, yeah.
And can you seal what you're doing directly over the top of it without me being concerned that there will be some sort of residual concern about the coal tar based seal?
Yes, you can go right over it.
You can go right over it.
No problem.
So it's not like a complete redo of a driveway.
No.
Okay. You can go right over the top of it. What's the cost comparison?
It could be about 10% more.
It's 10% more for the eco seal, mm-hmm. what you do. Okay. So the average driveway, what are you going to pay?
If it was $75, we might be $85.
Okay.
So it's not like a big cost for to be safe, I would think, is my term.
Right. So in terms of building markets, I mean, obviously, if you can get that into, you know, a large chain carrying the product, I mean, what format does it, you know, is it something that people can do themselves, or is it something?
Already Lowe's, Home Depot, True Value, they've already banned coal tar.
Right.
They only sell asphalt emulsion.
Yeah.
So that's a sign.
Yeah.
And there's probably 40-something bands throughout the country already.
Yeah.
In different communities, cities, and there's more all the time.
Right. So it's going to be contractors then that you want to try and convert.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. But isn't the asphalt industry, and again, it's going to do all of us good to at least listen to what they say, though. I mean, we all have our own self-interest, but aren't they going to say that we need more time to understand the long-term effects of even the EcoSeal products? And is there anything in an EcoSeal product that could be concerning or carcinogenic?
Nothing. Nothing in the product I manufacture.
But how do you know? So because I mean, this is just the thing about that. I mean, this is a claim that they'll come back with in terms of, you know, that every new product, you know, potentially needs its own research. You know, I mean, it's got petroleum in it. I hear your confidence in mm-hmm. it, but in terms of just, are you also looking to, you know, are there other tests going on the alternative sort of products to sort of provide some?
I actually send it out to California.
Right.
Samples all the time.
Yeah. And so where does that go to?
It goes to a place called. CPM is a California Pavement Maintenance. They're the biggest. They probably make 100,000 gallons a day.
Yep.
And that's a lot for a private person.
Right, sure.
So they do a lot of tests on different emulsions, and they run all the tests and make sure that they meet all the specs and that they will hold up. And, you know, sealer, some of the people think it doesn't hold up as well as coal tar. That's the big claim.
Right.
If it's put down right, and not over diluted, you know, that's the it lasts just as long.
Right. So what about things like so is it important for you to sort of stay abreast of the science, you know, like things like the EPA or the Environmental Protection Agency or other government agencies, you know?
Yes, it's important.
Are they getting into this space, this conversation?
Yeah, there's a website called Coal Tar Free Coal Tar America, that is a huge block.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah,
Coal Tar Free
America. Coal Tar Free America.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Bill can maybe help us understand as well. I don't think we've done our driveway in 5 years, probably mm-hmm. now, maybe four. And, you know, it gets little chinks and chunks and nicks in it. But is there an annual need to redo it, or is that what the industry tells you because they want you to do it every year?
Yeah.
And what do you tell customers about the need, how often you need to redo?
You don't do it every year because that's over-sealing. That's the problem they had with coal tar. People, you know, because there's so many people doing it now that the price dropped. So for 50 or 60 bucks every year, you get that nice clean driveway. Well, what it does is it builds up because coal tar sits on top and it cracks like paint. If you ever see spider webs.
But they tell you that you need to redo it every year because it cracks. That's wrong.
That's wrong because it's not wearing off. It's got to wear, where asphalt sealer penetrates a little bit.
Right.
You know, it doesn't sit on top.
And so issues, is it a different issue depending on, you know, where your weather, you know, the climatic conditions of places? Is that going to?
They say it in up in like northeast is tough for asphalt emulsion, but if it's made with the right additives and stuff, it holds up.
For how much? So If I call you tomorrow, mm-hmm. and again, we didn't invite Bill on to do an ad for him. We invited him in because we think there's a news angle here, and I think our listeners appreciate that. But if I called you tomorrow and I said, you're going to do my driveway, but when am I going to need to redo it? How soon?
Two to 3 years.
2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. See, I feel like at the very least, I see some folks in our neighborhood, and I think that they've just been told, mm-hmm. you got to do it every year.
What about
it's right around now?
And so the other thing, just in the minute or so we've got left, Bill, is also just things like large scale developments. You know, so if there are large campus projects like College Town or whatever. I mean, do you know what sort of car park sealant they're using in those kinds of, you know, more recent developments?
I don't know yet. I know that there's been a few. I just saw a spec come out for a couple of parking lots at U of R, and it spec'd both materials.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's the first time I've ever seen that.
Right. So it is starting to creep in terms of, because we do a lot of stuff on urban design, mm-hmm. as you mm-hmm. know, as everyone will tell you as well, but just in terms of talking with urban designers and things, that's obviously a huge, you know, developers are a huge factor because of the footprint of any of those kinds of developments are going to have a massive impact and stuff. Particularly with runoff, I think, you know, if we're looking at things like, you know, brownfield sites or, you know, even greenfield sites where they're going to, you know, drop a significant parking lot with a lot of parking space, that's, you know, potentially in rural areas like the Alabama, the Stamp facility they're proposing out in Alabama, that would be a, an interesting case in point to look at further down the line. So.
Thank you, by the way, Bill, for a very level-headed and not shrill discussion. And thanks for surprising me that you're a Prius driver. That's fascinating. It's the most interesting part. No, sing it from the rooftops. Right? He has arms like Popeye.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You, I just, it's absolutely fabulous.
He's a serious outdoor guy. We can see that. Bill Johnson from EcoSeal, based in Greece. Thanks very much for being with us on Innovation Friday.
And, thanks for having
very
me.
Interesting to hear all about that.
I appreciate
right.
it.
Thank Short you. Break coming up here, and then our team of Innovation Trail reporters around the state will check in with us next hour. And Matthew, what else do we have coming up?
So the first hour, that'll be the second half. Second half, Evan. The first half, we're going to talk about the issue of medical interpreters. So we know that there are 25 million people with limited proficiency in English in America. That has a very, very big impact on the quality of healthcare they get and on the readmission rates and the impact on things like health insurance. So we're going to talk about the whole experience of medical interpreters, what they mean, why they're important, and that's all. That's in the first half hour of right after the NPR news.
Yep, coming up in just a couple minutes right here on Member Supported Public Radio.